The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Hi, and welcome to the A16Z podcast. This episode is all about the state of security. As cyber, physical, and national security become one and the same, how does that change how we think about the problem and how we address it, from software to hardware? The conversation was recorded at our summit event in November 2017 and includes Stina Ehrensvard, founder and CEO of Yubico, Joel de la Garza, CISO at Box, and Niels Provost, distinguished engineer at Google, and is moderated by Martin Casado, general partner at A16Z.
I used to work for the intelligence community, and I used to go to these kind of think tanks for the government, which were about sovereignty-ending events. And so you'd have these different experts in different areas, and you'd think, what can we do to the U.S. critical infrastructure to create the end of sovereignty? And then you'd have the civil engineer, and you have the electrical engineer, and you have someone that understands hydro, and we'd all sit in a room. And what always struck me about this was two things. Like, number one, hydro security and electrical security. It's just like security, right? It's part of a security thing. And the second thing is, anytime you found a vulnerability, for example, in the electrical power grid, like the people that were responsible for it, they've kind of, you know, been like, yeah, okay, we'll do some incremental fix. Where for cybersecurity, we had to kind of our own world. And then anytime, you know, someone found a vulnerability, we're like, we don't understand what we're doing. We're going to kind of make it all over again. Have we evolved as a discipline enough so we can just stop talking about cybersecurity as this entirely special new thing, and we can just talk about security more broadly? Or is cybersecurity really that separate that it kind of deserves its entire discipline?
So pretty similarly at Citigroup, around 2005, we generally had the belief that, well, we're a bank, we're a financial intermediary, we run the global economy. People kind of don't want to destroy your business. They may want to steal from you, but the idea of someone coming in to destroy your business and to destroy a key piece of banking infrastructure seemed a little kind of far-fetched at the time. And then we had the Al-Qassam Cyber Brigade with the targeted attacks against Saudi Aramco. They turned all their PCs into bricks. And then we saw the Dark Soul attacks out of North Korea. And it became pretty clear to us that there are actually well-funded nation-state actors out there that just kind of want to destroy things. And that kind of changed the way we think about it, right? So I think to a large extent, there's a really weird thing about information security in that it's an industry that for the most part shouldn't exist. If you bought a car and your car dealer made you pay an extra $200 to not have your car go up in flames, you'd be able to sue them. And the cybersecurity industry, to some extent, is filling that gap of the software or the service that you bought is going up in flames. And so I think as business models evolve, as we make this transition to the cloud, as blockchain becomes more widely deployed, security starts to become more of a feature and less of a product. And I think we start thinking less about kind of the specific technical security issues and more broadly about business process and how we define these intermediary relationships.
Actually, let me challenge you on that slightly.
Awesome.
Why should we even care about security? Doesn't seem to cost anything if you don't have security. When I was giving this talk a couple of weeks ago, Future of Computer Security Research, and I was sort of wondering, have we done much over the last 30 years? And I talked with Dan Bonnet, a professor at Stanford, and he said, Niels, the purpose of computer security research, you know, he said they're really, you know, separate things that we have to do, right? We have to, you know, find new vulnerabilities, find defenses for them, and then make sure that industry is aware of it. And if you sort of look at it from that lens, we have done great. Over the last 20 years, we have found lots of new vulnerabilities. We have found lots of new defenses, but we don't seem to be able to translate them into practice. And if you look at every other week, we seem to be reading in the newspaper about another company that has been compromised. And so that really makes me wonder, it's probably not really a technology problem, it's an incentive problem. How do we create a world in which people actually want to have better security?
Stina?
So I do believe that security is the most critical thing we need to solve on the planet today, and it will affect every part of a business. Any software on a computer or a phone or a server eventually will be hacked. If you were talking about cars, you can't sell a car today if it's not safe. In the first cars that came, they didn't have any seatbelts, and people died, and someone said, oh, we need a seatbelt, and you know, then there's crash zones, and there's... But the three things that happened when that problem in our society, what is it, 6 years ago happened, it had to be easy. The three-point seatbelt is easy. It had to just be there, natively supported in the car. It shouldn't be something that you have to be difficult to go and get. And then it has to be an open standard. And eventually the government said, hey, you need the seatbelt or we'd sue you. And I think that's sort of the same process that this industry is taking. super easy to use. You don't even have to think about it, just there. Standards that make it native. And the government is already starting to take some actions with the GDPR and other things.
I'd love if you could describe a little bit about kind of Y2FA and what it means, and then what you think government's role is in this broader question.
The number one biggest security challenge that we're facing on the internet today is a stolen username and password. Probably 90% of every breach you read about is a user credential that has been compromised. And it's either a static password or a weak one, you know, two-factor authentication like SMS or an app that is being taken. So if you just say, let's not try to solve every problem on the planet, just 90%, then let's do that. And the first implementation of that is the YubiKey that you plug into your computer and you touch it. And there's all kind of security smart things happen behind the scene. But from a user perspective, you literally just touch it or you tap it to your phone.
And if I may very quickly interrupt, we have mandated a hardware second factor for everybody at Google since 2009. You know, everybody is using a security key nowadays. We have not had a single successful phishing attack against a Google employee since then.
So I want to continue to dig into this question, because what I've heard is I've heard Google, which everybody knows, saying this is a good way to do things, and many people following. I've heard an open standard, which is an industry consortium, but I'm actually curious if government does have a role. Actually, Joel, you used to work for the government. Do you think this is something that the industry is solving and with these two huge innovators like we're seeing, or do you think that there is kind of more of a public role in this?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways that the government can help and a couple ways that it's historically hurt. Part of my job working as a CISO, CSO for an internet property or a bank is that you get to get involved with people that try to hack you, and you get to make decisions about whether or not you're going to prosecute them, work with law enforcement, how that relationship's going to happen. The criminal justice laws, the laws around computer intrusions in this country are really profoundly broken. There's not a lot of sophistication or nuance in them. It's essentially treating every kind of computer intrusion like it was armed robbery. And that creates a lot of problems with when you decide to prosecute and how you want to like pursue any kind of legal remedies around these issues. So that's one area where historically we've seen businesses get hurt, we've seen individuals get hurt, we've seen some pretty negative things. On the positive side, the adoption of the NIST 853 standard by the U.S. government for cloud security, for cloud vendors, basically the U.S. government said, if you want to sell services to us, you have to adhere to this baseline security standard. I'm typically of the opinion that compliance and security are the enemies of each other. But this is one instance where I think it's actually really starting to raise the bar. And to the earlier point about automobiles and safety, I think we're going to get to a point where our consumer electronics will have that kind of security stamp on the back that'll be based on some kind of measurable, meaningful standards. I don't know if it's going to happen within my lifetime, but hopefully it does at some point.
Niels, where do you think the government's involved? Is it possible for the government to be involved in a way that's net benefit or you don't have to cross-check? I mean, how do you view that?
So we were talking about compliance standards, and frequently what they achieve is compliance. They don't achieve security. Maybe the standard Joel mentioned, NIST 853, may change that. But there are sort of, you know, some fundamentals that still tend to be true about security, right? One of them is we don't really know how to write secure code.
Yeah.
So that means that one of the things that we always must be able to do is patching. And now if you have government regulations that say, you know, FIPS 142, that essentially create incentives not to patch, you're probably not better off. It does seem that government realizes that maybe the commercial clouds are a place for them as well. They can help with maybe changing the way that we look at regulation and actually create best practices and standards that meaningfully improve security.
So between Steen and Niels, we've got two representatives of like hardware roots of trust being used in security in a very serious way. I mean, so YubiKey is a hardware key that you put in and that provides you a root of trust. You know, so Google is actually very famous for the Titan chip. So the servers have like a specific chip, which is a hardware root of trust, which the security community for a long time has been saying that you need hardware roots of trust. Now, Joel has had deep industry and experience on the buyer side, both at a bank and at a startup, where you don't have the same level of control that perhaps Google does or a vendor does. And so like how practical is or how much of a shift do you think the industry needs to go through? Well, A, first, do you think like hard roots of trust are required? And B, is this something that we think can practically be adopted broadly or?
Wow, that's a loaded one.
Maybe.
I mean, historically we've had issues. So we've been working with a lot of the commercially available hardware roots of trust, not represented by anyone on the stage, but I won't disclose the vendors, and have generally found that a lot of those hardware solutions have some pretty serious security issues, key extractions possible on a number of them. There's a bunch of CVSS vulnerabilities that we've reported, or CV vulnerabilities we reported around some of those products. I think there's two sides to that equation, right? Like defense contractors, heavily regulated industries will continue to need that hardware root of trust. I think what's more interesting to me is a lot of the stuff that Amazon is doing around KMS and some of the stuff that Google's doing around their virtualized key services. Anything that can make that kind of root of trust beyond kind of saving secrets locally in a not safe way can really help drive kind of security across the organization. But by and large, it is very difficult to integrate a lot of these things. And for us as a relatively small company compared to a Google, it's hard to make those investments in building in hardware and getting custom chips printed. That's a dream.
So Tina, I think, you know, Yubico has done some of the fundamental work in making hardware roots of trust generally accessible. And you've spent a lot of time in the field. Like, how open do you find the industry being to that idea and then their ability to consume this?
Absolutely not open at all.
Really?
I mean, when I started this company 10 years ago, people said, this is not the future. The future is biometrics, sensors, big data, geolocation, mobile apps, everything but a hardware, USB and NFC key. But eventually, you know, I'm here. So I think the time has worked with us. And I'm not saying that any of the other things that I mentioned is not also the future. It's just like there is a clear need for that hardware root of trust in addition to all the other things that we also want, because security has to be monitored and managed on many levels. So we're not solving all the security problems with the hardware key.
And it also depends on who you really want to serve.
Yeah.
So Google rolled out this advanced protection program where you are forced to associate a security key with your account. That's the only way that you can get into your account. But that is not something that we can offer to billions of users. That is something where we might go to journalists or dissidents or people who we believe are specifically targeted by more advanced adversaries to say, look, you know, for you, this may be of a real benefit. And then the question is, how much utility do you lose? Is it convenient? And with the NFC UB keys, right, you put them at the back of your phone. The phone is then bootstrapped with the secret it needs and you go. So I think that has become much easier than it used to be.
I know as a GP in a large firm, I'm more and more concerned about security. And so I'm like moving off of email and I'm using Signal. What would you recommend as far as like a tool chain for like the most paranoid of us? Is it like the normal thing and like you wait for IT? Is there things that we can do on our behavior?
I continue to be a big proponent of something like a Chromebook with a security key, right? Essentially, you have an endpoint that cannot be compromised, even if you try. Because the weak point in all of this continues to be the human. I can talk anybody, including myself, into doing something that we should not be doing. And so with a Chromebook, you get the benefit of you can't install software anymore, right?
Yeah.
One of the largest vectors for people being compromised. And then it sort of really depends on your level of paranoia. You may want to get the advanced protection program, right? You probably want to use Signal or, you know, some other open whisper system, but that's not the recipe for everybody. It's not general guidance.
Joel, I mean, are there things that like lay end users can do that will meaningfully improve things, or is this really a problem for the CISO or the organization?
We also do 2FA for all of our services, and whenever an executive goes to a hostile foreign nation, we send them with a Chromebook, and then we donate it to a charity in East Palo Alto so that their intelligence agents can watch kids grow and develop. It's kind of a joke we play on people. I would say that, you know, beyond that, where we get our single largest return on investment in terms of security spend is around training and engagement and just helping get people like yourselves to know that you're targeted, how you're going to be targeted. We've seen a lot of the issues move out of the targeted phishing attacks to the like, I'm buying you a drink at a bar, or I'm talking to you at a conference to solicit private information. It's really just about getting people to understand kind of the human side of this, because we are essentially the weakest link in any kind of security model that we build. And it's really about kind of investing after you've taken care of patching universal 2FA and then your Chromebooks, educating your users on just being paranoid about what the risk is and how it works.
But if you do that, you're already at a pretty good.
You're really good. Yes. You're doing a great job. Yeah, that's 90% of it.
And I mean, given all the things on the table, how do you prioritize?
So assume you're being targeted by a nation state actor with a lot of resources, a lot of skill, and sort of potential catastrophe that you want to avoid. How do you prioritize closing your gaps? And for the most part, we have not figured that out, right? We do not know how to measure risk. And so, you know, for companies such as Google, we just invest a lot of resources and money in security. But for other companies, that really becomes a problem. And then it goes back to the, what are the incentives? Yeah. Right? If security doesn't really cost you anything, you know, if you get breached, why should you invest in it? And then you get companies such as Equifax losing a lot of very sensitive information, and you wonder, Did they really get any lasting harm from that? So it's not clear.
With the GDPR in Europe, it will cost a company if they get breached. It's 4% of their revenue if they have not taken the security measures needed.
Right, and surprisingly, Europe continues to be forward-looking.
I'm Swedish-American, but I do believe that European has started with security. Here in America, it's been more about convenience and speed, while Europe has sort of, the convenience and speed is not as important as security.
Yeah, generally, I think the hacker's sort of mentality or the intruder's mentality, whether it's nation-state or whatever the case, is going to be why pick the lock if the window's open. If you can just take care of a lot of these basics, you can really up-level it. If you get to the point where you're worried about, like, the Mossad, you're probably already dead, right? Like, it's just good luck.
Well, another thing that remains true is adversaries often go to the place where the bar is lower,
yeah.
Right? So you oftentimes don't need to achieve perfect security as long as security is noticeably higher than somebody else.
Run faster than the bear.
Right, yeah. Yes.
All right, so in 10 years, let's say the four of us are back up here in front of this audience, will the problem be just as bad? Will it be better or will it be worse? And why?
I am a true optimist. I believe that the world is going to be much better in 10 years. And going back to the car and the seatbelts, today we have 10 times more cars on the street compared to 60 years ago. And we have actually fewer fatal accidents. And it's because there is built-in security. So security is going to be native in platforms and browsers with standards. And that's the key.
In 10 years, everybody is going to be on a professionally run cloud that takes care of all of your security needs.
Is that what it is? Right,
what he said. No, I think that hopefully my goal is to put myself out of a job in a positive way, not in a negative way. And that in 10 years, it's all about standards. And then it ultimately becomes about risk transfer, right? Some form of insurance. And it's about leveraging standards to mitigate as much of the risk as possible and then transferring the risk that you can't control through some kind of an insurance policy.
So the cloud discussion cuts both ways. Some people will be like, actually moving to the cloud is less secure because there's larger attack surface, et cetera. And you've been making this argument for quite a while now that the cloud will make you more secure. Why do you think that is the argument over?
You just end up getting economies of scale. There are lots of companies that can just not afford the level of security that's required these days.
Yeah.
And companies such as Google or Microsoft or Amazon will just be able to do that much, much better. Fair than enough. You could do yourself. That's not said that there won't be some companies who will still be better off doing it themselves because they can invest all the resources.
Yeah.
But that's going to be the minority.
Thank you very much. Please help me thank the panelists.
Thank you.